never been, and I've never wanted to be, a career politician. My aim in being in politics was to get Britain out of the European Union.
The former First Lady met with federal investigators at FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C. on Saturday. The statement said the meeting lasted 3.5 hours.
I now feel that I've done my bit, that I couldn't possibly achieve more.
I've been coming to this for years, and it's sort of frustrating that it has to be a big thing. It shouldn't be a big thing that the Prime Minister's walking in Pride Parade, and from now on it won't.
And so I feel it's right that I should now stand aside as leader of UKIP.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. It is 5:08 and it is Monday. No, it's Tuesday, I think. July 5th, 2016, 2016. That's what happens when you have a day off. Good morning. Welcome to another business day. Welcome to another edition of The Opening Bell. Happy belated 4th of July. Hopefully your day yesterday was as good as ours, and we hope you had a relaxing, safe holiday time. You know, I was thinking over the weekend, what exactly is the American dream? You know, this is something that we get up and go to work for every day, right? We sort of have a dream of what it is to have things in America and to live that so-called American dream. And lo and behold, this morning there's a new survey out that says, here's what people think the American dream is. 78% having personal freedom, 75% just having basic needs met, so just whatever they need to survive every day. 71% achieving one's personal goals, 67% just having enough free time, and 54% being in harmony with nature. So those are some of the surveys, some of the responses from people responding to what it is, what the American dream means to you as an American, as you get up and go to work and kind of slough through every day, you know, going to your job. So there it is. Let's go to the WGN market desk. You heard some of the numbers from Vic Vaughn this morning. Let's see what they're doing now. The Dow futures generally lower this morning, off almost 100 points. The NASDAQ and S&P futures are also lower today. Overseas, European markets generally all lower, and in Asia generally all lower. In Japan, almost by about 1%. In Europe, more than 1%, sometimes some places 1.5%. The DAX, for instance, almost 1.5% this morning. We'll continue to follow that aspect of business throughout the morning. Some of the top business stories this morning include this one. The leading conservative candidate, as you heard in our opening there, Nigel Farage, has stepped out of the spotlight. He wants to now go away after he says he's accomplished his goal of getting Britain out of the EU. Also, that McDonald's is in the news this morning. Fast food chains based in Oak Brook says it is investing 500 million euros to modernize its restaurants in Germany. The company says 72 restaurants of the future, as they're calling them, will start offering custom-made burgers, children's play areas, and even table service beginning on Monday. That's in Germany. The day ahead, economic day ahead, traders will have one economic report from the government to consider today as Wall Street opens an abbreviated week following Independence Day. Commerce is set to release factory orders at about 9 o'clock Chicago time this morning. Well, this morning we want to bring you our CEO Spotlight sponsored by Allstate, normally scheduled for Mondays, but we were off yesterday, so we'll bring it to you today. And this is one that's sort of near and dear to my heart. You know, if you haven't been listening, I'm a dog person. I love dogs. And we found a saint in the Chicago area, a literal saint who is helping dogs, retired canines who work for police departments and law enforcement agencies and other agencies. And she started a foundation, and it's called Mark Nye, Medical Assistance for Retired Canines. And the CEO and founder of that is Dr. Alexis Newman, who was also a veterinarian at Partners and Paws Veterinary Service in the suburbs. And she's the focus of our CEO Spotlight this morning. Alexis, thanks first for being with us this morning. And I guess, you know, I'll just start, and I think I know the answer to this question. What gets you out of bed every morning and gets you to the veterinary clinic?
I am so fortunate to have a career that I'm passionate about. I'm passionate about the animals. I'm passionate about working with these police and other working dogs. And so I really do love going to work and doing whatever we can to help these animals.
The foundation that you're starting, the Mark 9 Medical Assistance for Retired Canines, where did you get the idea for that, and why is it so important?
Great question. I've been working with these canines for quite a while, and what happens when they retire, some of them are older, some are a bit younger. They have numerous medical conditions, and there's typically a transaction with the department, so the handler pays $1 and now owns that dog, which is great, but then they own the dog's health problems too. And handlers, like all other people, are concerned about finances, and they're retiring at an age when they have significant medical conditions, and ironically, that's when the handlers are now responsible for them. There's never been, with any department I know of, any sort of funding for these dogs once they become the property of the owner. So the owner or the handlers are now paying for their medical cost out of pocket.
Illinois, like a couple of other states, has tried to legislate this, and I believe there's a bill waiting to be signed that would force most of the police agencies and law enforcement agencies to provide a retirement for their dogs. I'm guessing you think that's a good idea.
Absolutely. You know, just like the officers have a pension, these dogs were bred for this condition. They were acquired by the department. This is what they do. They have a career. They spend 90% to 100% of their lifespan working for the department, and there's no thought given to how to care for them after they're retired.
It is concerning to me because I'm sure our audience will think about this too. They've seen many police dogs who have died in the line of duty or who have had to be euthanized while they're still on duty. And the police departments and law enforcement, other organizations, the fire departments, make big deal out of that. There's usually a procession and the police are saluting, and there's usually an honors funeral. Why doesn't that carry over, though, to the thinking after this dog retires?
That's a great question. I often ask myself, I'm always proud when there's a procession and they're given the honor they deserve. And yet behind the scenes, I know that they're not always given that honor when they're on duty, or certainly when they're off duty. Once they're off duty, they're retired. They're, I think, a little bit out of sight, out of mind. You know, here the handler took him. He's no longer an employee or an officer. He's a retired officer, and he doesn't come to the station. He doesn't ride in the squad. And I think they just don't think about it. And it tends not to be a priority to consider them for many departments in the line item when they're budgeting.
We're talking with Alexis Newman, who is the founder of Mark 9, retired police dogs, a foundation that's helping retired police dogs. It stands for Medical Assistance for Retired Canines. And our conversation with Alexis will continue this morning in the Allstate CEO Spotlight, sponsored by Allstate.
From ABC News, Wall Street Now. It's back to work for the stock market. Asian shares were mixed overnight, but a fresh batch of economic data will give investors here a fresh read on the U.S. economy, as well as the health of corporate America when the second quarter begins in a few weeks. Investors are showing strong interest in the computer gaming business. Sony, Activision, and Electronic Arts all posted strong returns in the second quarter, a period when most NASDAQ components were essentially flat. The U.S. Senate is making the big switch from BlackBerry to Android and iPhones. The sergeant-at-arms says staffers will no longer receive new BlackBerries because of concerns that production of the OS X devices might be halted. BlackBerry says it has no plan to shut down its assembly lines. And big changes are coming to Big Boy, the regional restaurant chain under new ownership since last August. Revamped dining rooms and a new menu featuring Brupper, breakfast at supper, and a noticeably slimmed-down Big Boy statue out front are all on the way. Jim Ryan, ABC News.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. In the Allstate CEO Spotlight today, Alexis Newman, the founder and chairman CEO of Medical Assistance for Retired Canines, with the abbreviation Mark 9, founded in the Chicago suburbs, with the sole goal of helping retired canines, so police dogs who are retired and then who have no one to care for them. They have their owners, obviously, and handlers, but she raises the money and helps take care of them and their medical needs, that sorts of thing. Believe it or not, police departments, most police departments do not do that. They don't provide the money for them. And our conversation continues now. Alexis, this goes well beyond retired canines. You're out there every day helping current canines.
Absolutely. It certainly varies by department. Some departments are extremely supportive. A dog has an injury or a concern, whatever it needs is their answer, and that's great. Others are well, let's see what we can work with, and do we need to do that now? Can we defer that treatment? Versus whatever he needs. They still need to go back out on their shift the following week or day or whenever they're working next. And we even some, again, it varies quite a lot by department, and I understand they have budget constraints, but these canines put officer safety at, they're very important in terms of getting the officers home that day. So many times canines will enter a building that you wouldn't want an officer going in first, and they clear the building. We never know how many officers would be down without the canines going in first. We do lose several dozen canines a year in the line of duty, but what that tells us is that many more human officers that went home to their families.
I met you when you we'll back up to last year when there was a search for the missing police officer, or the people who we thought at the time had killed a suburban police officer, ended up he taking his own life. But one of the things I want to get across to our listeners is what you do before the dogs retire. You have a medical van and you go out to where these dogs are in action. And that day, I remember meeting you, and you were telling us about how the dogs, so many of them were near dehydration, and if you hadn't kind of responded to that scene, that hot day they were all out searching, we could have actually lost some of those police dogs that day.
Definitely. That's a great point, too, of how they're an afterthought. That was an incredible day that a lot of us won't forget for a long time, and there were 48 canine teams on scene, which is an astronomical number of dogs working together. Yeah. And it was a very hot day. All of the officers and first responders were drinking and getting IVs themselves. And as an afterthought, I was called by some of the handlers personally and asked to come out. 48 dog teams were out there, and there was no official medical standby. So we're hoping that changes now with enough connections and with my position as a veterinarian for many of these working dogs. I don't think we'd see a mass incident where we're not on site. I do often say I have the best job in the world. I get to go out in the field, hang out. We do have a working ambulance that we can treat dogs in. So in Fox Lake last year, we treated probably about 40 of those 48 dogs. Several of them, I'm fairly certain, would have succumbed to the heat had we not been able to treat them. It was wonderful. It's an honor to be out there to treat them, but it's worrisome to think that it was an afterthought, and there, up until then, at least, veterinary care wasn't in part of the planning. You know, you can imagine how many ambulances and first responders were there if something did occur with the humans, mm-hmm. which obviously is a priority. But again, we kind of rolled up a couple hours in as a here we are now.
and I think it's important to say you rolled up sort of at your own expense, that oftentimes you do this at your own expense. You shut down your veterinary practice, get in this dog ambulance and go, and you're there on your own dime.
You're right. And again, I'm fortunate to be able to do it and love it and wouldn't trade it. But for many of those dogs, they were my patients already. For many of the dogs, I might have known them or hadn't met them, and I treated them. And we did not build the departments because, again, there's no standard for it. There's no setup. There's no protocol in place to treat these animals when they are on scene like that.
I recently saw a picture of you in the Daily Herald. There was a nice story about how you were teaching first aid to some of these
Correct.
Departments. Is that something that came out of the Glenowitz Fox Lake incident that some of these departments have pledged to, hey, we're going to start taking this more seriously?
That's a great question. I think so, because I think we're seeing it now with the SWAT teams. You know, we are thinking proactively. And mm-hmm. I think myself talking with some of the handlers that during that incident, it was like, hey, we should think of this for the future. And it should happen that it also has a lot to do with those departments that are proactive. Couple departments individually say, you know what, we have a canine. We do not want anything happening to canine our paramedics can't handle. And they've had us come in and teach the medics. They already know the medicine. They just need to know the canine and the anatomy. So it's actually fun for them, I think, and gives the department peace of mind that their sworn officer, although he's a canine, will now get appropriate care. And then the great thing is, it doesn't stop there. Now the medics are trained. There's a pet in a house fire, a pet in a vehicle accident. They now feel comfortable and confident that they can help. And that it really comes down to the individual departments and the administration support of the canine unit.
And what kind of also sparked me, sparked the idea to have you in on our CEO Spotlight series was the recent passing of Brittany, the last 9/11 dog.
Right.
After, I think, what, 15 years, maybe 16?
Amazing.
And here you have a dog that retired as a hero, even though she wasn't able to make any rescues at 9/11. That was kind of a painful thing. But it sort of brings up, you know, that aside from the medical part of this, the retirement of these working dogs, they do kind of want to keep working even after they're retired, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. I'm actually a fan. You know, there's different philosophies in the canine world. If I had my choice, the majority of canines would retire on duty. There are some that get older and they're sore and they're okay staying home, to be honest. But many of them do get euthanized on duty, and they were happy working till the end as long as they're with their handler. But Mark 9 is for those dogs who don't retire on duty, and they do get to retire and become family pets. But they're still... they still have that drive in them. They may not have the joints they used to have, but they have that drive.
What does retirement on duty look like? What is that?
You know, that's a great question, too, because it varies. Sometimes retirement on duty can be tough. It changes the handler's world. The handler's still an officer. They're no longer canine. They no longer go to a every other week training class or training session. The great majority of canine units have a group they train with every 2 weeks. So suddenly you have an officer who goes to work every day. He doesn't have a squad car with canine on it. He has a different position, and the dog now stays home. And that can be really tough for some of these dogs. They don't understand why they're suddenly not walking out the door when their handler's in uniform. Some of them, of course, adapt better, and they're on the couch when the handler gets home, and they're doing great. Others, it takes a few weeks to a few months to acclimate to staying home, and the handlers have to try to work to keep them active when the handler's off duty so they can still feel like they're working.
And so if you're listening at home and you're saying, how the heck can I help Mark 9, this is where you can help if you're listening. Your annual fundraiser, the big one, is coming up pretty quickly, the annual golf outing. So people can help how?
So this is our second annual golf outing. The first one was sold out with a great success. We had wonderful sponsors. We were asking for donations that can be given either through the website or PayPal or mailed to the address on the website, which is mark9.com. Everybody can feel free to come out for the golf outing itself, or we have a dinner with a raffle. And it's a fun event because everybody's out there for the same goal. Everybody is a dog lover. Probably only half the people last year were actually handlers. The other half were other officers or just the public who cared. And we have dogs out on the course with their handlers riding on the golf course. So we try to make it fun for the public, too. And this year we're planning on a couple demos just to see these dogs working, doing a little bit of work, because it's exciting to see what they do. And I've been working with them for 10 years. I'm still amazed at, you know, watching their demos every time. They're amazing.
That's Alexis Newman, Dr. Alexis Newman of the Veterinary Paws, a veterinary clinic, also the CEO and founder of Mark 9, which stands for Medical Assistance for Retired Canines. So you can find them, by the way, online at mark-9.com and find more ways that you can donate. Again, their golf outing is coming up on July 22nd.
From ABC News, Tech Trends. The first big update for Windows 10 is on its way. Microsoft's Lindsay Matisse says it continues to be the fastest growing version of Windows ever.
Since last summer, more than 350 million devices are now running Windows 10.
She says the anniversary update, as it's called, will include a number of breakthrough features.
On August 2nd, new features like Windows Ink, updates to Cortana, improved security features, and a more seamless gaming experience means everyone can be more productive while still having fun.
With this update, Microsoft will also bring Cortana and two other highly requested features to the Xbox One gaming console. The company is also offering a back-to-school deal for students.
Students receive $300 off an Xbox One and Surface Book or Surface Pro 4, or get a free TV with the purchase of a Dell PC over $699.
If you haven't already done so, you can upgrade your computer's operating system to Windows 10 for free through July 29th. With Tech Trends, I'm Chuck Sievertson, ABC News.
Now, WGN Radio's Daily Conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome to the program. Welcome back. It's 5:36, the business of health in this segment as we focus on the Zika virus. You've been hearing a lot about it lately. A number of athletes have been canceling their appearances in the Summer Olympics in Rio de Janeiro because of the fear of Zika virus. The World Health Organization's cautioning against travel around the world against this, also to pay extra attention, if especially you live in southern climates where the mosquito that carries this is prevalent. Dr. Lee Jampol is with the Louis Feinberg School of Medicine in Chicago from Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine, professor of ophthalmology there, and is with us this morning on The Opening Bell. Dr. Jampol, good morning. Welcome to The Bell.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. How are you?
Excellent.
Wonderful. I have a wonderful story about another Northwestern doctor, but you guys have really good dry senses of humor. When I had a surgery recently, I didn't get a lot of sleep that night, and I said to my doctor when he came in, I said, you know, I didn't sleep very well last night. He said, oh, that's okay. I got 13 hours. I'm fine. So it was funny. But the Zika virus is a big concern. It seems to be that we're hearing more and more about seriousness of this as more investigation is done. Can you give us a status on where this is at now and how serious it is as a worldwide threat?
So the Zika virus originated in Africa, and it was found in mosquitoes, and it was thought to be a relatively minor infection in humans until recently. It spread from Africa to Polynesia, and then in 2015, it jumped to Brazil. What facilitated its spread is this Aedes aegypti mosquito that is very adapted to urban environments, and it likes to bite humans during the day. So it spread very rapidly in Brazil. There's several million cases of the virus that have occurred in Brazil. So with such large numbers of people being infected, most of them still did just fine. They had no symptoms or just a little fever and a rash that cleared up after a week or two. But at the same time, it was noted that there was this epidemic that suddenly appeared of microcephaly, which means that babies were being born with small brains and small skulls. And somebody put it together that that might be related to the infection of Zika that was spreading throughout Brazil. And that's now been confirmed. We now know that if a pregnant woman gets infected by the virus, there's a chance, particularly during the first trimester, there's a chance that the baby will have damage to the brain and to other organs. We don't know exactly what percentage of the women that are infected this is going to happen to, but there are so many people being infected that in Brazil, there are many, many babies being born with these brain abnormalities.
And there are a couple of concerning parts, too, about what you have said. First, I'll go back to the mosquito that bites during the daytime. That's odd in itself, isn't it?
Yes, that's an adaptation to the urban environment, and with humans being the main reservoir of the infection. So this mosquito was really adjusted to humans, and therefore it's very successful throughout the tropical climates around the world. And it not only carries Zika, but it carries some other bad infections also, like dengue virus and yellow fever and other viruses. So this everywhere that this virus is present in the tropical climates, there's a real potential damage from Zika and these other viruses.
And there is also the investigation that's ongoing, too, about the biting of the infection of a male and then spreading that to a female through sexual contact. Has that been confirmed yet, or is it still under investigation?
So there are just a few cases that have been reported of that. It's clear that the vast majority of infections are due to mothers infected during pregnancy. But it's possible that male-to-female transmission can occur if the male had the infection. He might not have known he had the infection. It might have been so mild, or he might have recovered and not thought about it. But if he had the infection, it's possible in the semen to spread the infection to the female. Again, our main concern really is pregnant women, because the infection otherwise, there are exceptions in adults getting very ill from the virus, but the main concern is pregnant women getting infected.
So what needs to be the attack here, and what is not happening to facilitate it happening fast enough and well enough?
Well, I think there are many, all the public health doctors from around the world are dealing with this. The DNA specialists are dealing with this, the infectious disease specialists. So the world's really woken up. And after the Ebola virus in Africa killed so many people, the response to Zika has been much, much better than it was to Ebola. The main way to control the infection now is with mosquito control. And there's the usual spreading and spraying to kill the mosquitoes. But they're also working on very sophisticated genetic ways to release mosquitoes that are sterile and can't have offspring into the environment and therefore prevent the mosquitoes from proliferating.
Is that something that you're comfortable with?
It's still so preliminary that we don't know the safety of that and we don't know the efficacy of that. But the experiments are being done in the United States and elsewhere to see if this sterile mosquito is a way to go. I don't think that's going to impact the current infection at all. Now, there's an interesting phenomenon. That is, the first year that the infection shows up in a place like Brazil or the southern United States, it's very devastating because nobody has immunity to the virus. But if the virus is around for a year, and the second year it's much milder because a whole bunch of people in the environment are now immune to the infection, and therefore it can't spread as rapidly to other people. So I think that the worst situation in Brazil is this year. If it comes to the United States again, the major damage is going to be at the first year of infection. And then after that, the infection is not quite so dangerous in terms of spread.
Let me go back to something you said there about the United States, because this is something that I hear a lot from people, and that is, well, it's not in the United States. We don't have to worry about it. Is this something that we should be worrying about?
So far, the infections in the United States are people that acquired the problems of with the babies being born are people that acquired the infections in South and Central America or in Puerto Rico. So there are no cases that I'm aware of right now of someone where the Zika virus was obtained from a mosquito in the United States. But we do have that mosquito in Florida, in Texas, along the Gulf Coast. And so it's quite possible that this summer the infection could spread into the southern parts of the United States. We really haven't seen that yet. It's also possible in the future that other mosquitoes that are related to that, that are present much further north, could carry the virus as well. But this is very speculative at this point.
It's speculative in the sense that it hasn't happened yet, but we have seen other viruses do that, right? I mean, like, for instance, who would have thought we would have ever seen West Nile virus come to Chicago? So it can't happen, right?
So West Nile virus started in Africa and then spread from Israel to New York City. And then it moved rapidly across the United States and is now present in all 48 lower states. But that's spread by a different mosquito, the Culex mosquito that we have around here in Chicago. So West Nile virus is a danger. But again, since it's been around for a while, we're not seeing an epidemic of it. We're seeing occasional cases. Some of the population are immune to it, et cetera. So we don't know if the Culex mosquito can carry it. It probably can't, but we're not sure about that. But a cousin of the Aedes aegypti is in Chicago and could potentially carry the virus.
Let me ask you a silly question because I don't know the answer to it, and that is, how does a mosquito that has this bring it here? Is it something that does it travel with somebody? Is it hidden away on somebody's clothing? How would one of these mosquitoes bring this virus to our country?
Well, I think they travel the same way we travel. They can get on an airplane and travel that way. It spread from Polynesia to Brazil. We don't know exactly how, but it was speculated it might be with sporting events that were held in Brazil where people from Polynesia were there. That has not been proven, but it gets on an airplane or someone that's sick with the virus and either knows it or doesn't know it, takes the flight and then arrives in the United States. And then a mosquito here, an Aedes aegypti, bites that person, and you're off and running.
And so as we talk about this, microencephaly is something very serious. It's irreversible, right? It's a permanent birth defect.
So it looks like there's a spectrum of damage from somewhat milder infections to really severe, devastating infection where there's hardly any brain left at all. And the exact neurologic consequences in these babies that are being born now is not really worked out. We don't know their functioning. We don't know what percentage of them are really severe or moderate or mild. Remember, the epidemic in Brazil started in 2015, so there's only small numbers of these babies that have been born and have had time to be thoroughly investigated and followed to see what their development is. But it's obvious that some of these babies, it's really severe damage. So.
Right. And seeing the pictures of them is just heartbreaking, some of the children who have this. Doctor, let me ask you this. As we talk about Zika, you mentioned West Nile. This is something that, regardless of what disease it is, our mosquito protection should be on high alert this summer, shouldn't it?
Yes, I think that. Well, in Chicago, I'm not worried about Zika so much, but there certainly is West Nile virus around. I think that we have to get more permanent ways to rid ourselves of mosquitoes, because the main problem around the world with mosquitoes is malaria. And so we need a way that kills many, many more people than all of these other viruses. And we need to have a way to get rid of the mosquitoes so that we can get rid of these diseases as killers.
Dr. Lee Champol of the Louis Feinberg Professor of Ophthalmology at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Doctor, thanks for being on with us this morning. Thanks for the good information.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
551 on the WGN Market Desk this morning. Dow futures are lower, off 69 points now. The NASDAQ and S&P futures lower as well. NASDAQ futures and S&P futures almost 0.5% lower. We're expecting a lower open on Wall Street later this morning. Let's get the latest on commodities now. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. Well, 3 days since we had any market activity in the U.S., so maybe a quick review of what happened last week, because it was a pretty good week for livestock futures at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. The August live cattle contract for the day Friday settled down $1.85 a hundredweight, but the contract gained 1.9% for the week, the first weekly gain in 4 weeks and the largest since April. Feeders climbed 2% last week, their biggest gain since March, and hogs on a continuous chart fell 4.1% for the week in the biggest drop since April. Cash hogs also ended the week lower going into the holiday weekend because most of the processing plants were closed today. Now, let's look at what happened in the grain market last week as we came to an end for the week. The Board of Trade soft red winter wheat contract was down 7.7%, biggest weekly decline in 2 years. Corn futures fell 4.5%. Soybeans, on the other hand, gained 5.5%. That's their biggest weekly gain since October of 2014. The crop progress reports will be watched carefully this afternoon because some heavy rains moved across the central part of the corn-soybean belt, missed us here in northern Illinois and on north, but south, some pretty good rains probably helping those dry fields. Have a good day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
All right, you too, Orion. Thank you. It's 5:53 now as we close out the opening bell with one final note about Zika virus and West Nile virus, as we were talking about that in our last segment. There have been several years now where bats have been on the decline across the U.S. Bats they love to eat mosquitoes, and the white nose syndrome sort of decimated a lot of the bat populations. There's a story out of North Hampstead, New York today, where the town is getting together to actually attract bats to their neighborhood so that they can kill these mosquito these virus-carrying mosquitoes, the Zika, West Nile. They're building bat houses and I'll call them bat caves, but they're little bat houses that they put in their trees. And it's actually having a big effect. The Boy Scouts are helping there. The local botanic garden is helping. And any resident who wants one of these bat houses can have the Boy Scouts come out and put one in. A great way to help fight mosquitoes. You heard the doctor in our last segment say we've got to find a way to do that. What a great idea. Again, out of North Hempstead, New York, where the community is building bats. By the way, bats can eat up to 1,000 mosquitoes per hour. So the local expert there says no pesticide could do that.